Oh, yeah, now it's funny. Okay, I think I got it. We'll see. Fabulous. Like, all of you are going to go back and listen to this anyway, right? Seriously. You're all here. I don't care if they record it. I'm here. That's why I'm here. So I don't have to listen to it later. Anyway, all right. Judges 6. Let's go there. Just to clarify from yesterday, did you guys catch the – Jacob asked me at the end of it, as we were talking about Sisera and the Warriors and all that, did you guys catch the meaning behind what I didn't say with what was happening at the end of the battle with the women and the two wombs and everything? Okay, this was not consensual in case we're – I didn't make that clear enough, so just wanted to make sure that that was understood. So, yes, there are times where Israel will go in and take wives from captives, if you will, but it's consensual. It's the idea of repentance, and if people will worship their God, then they are allowed to take them for wives. What is happening here is certainly not that. Okay, so just Jacob asked a good question. I wanted to just make sure there was clarity on that as to what was actually happening. Okay, so chapter 6. Let's pick up on now our fifth judge. We've seen Othniel, right, our boy at the very beginning, related to Caleb. We see Ehud, our boy that short guy, left-handed. Okay, insomnia hit me this morning, by the way. I started researching which side of the hip you're supposed to wear swords on. So you guys, you know, Eric screwed me up yesterday as well. So for whatever reason, and then I research it, and it's like 50-50. I'm like, doggone it. So anyway. I don't know what the right answer is, but we do know where he wore it, whether he cross-drew, whether he drew from the right side. Y'all don't care anyway. But this is the stuff I do at 2:30 in the morning when I can't sleep and send emails to random people. So there you go. So regardless, but that's what's going on. Where was I? Squirrel. Chapter 6. Let's start there. Okay. Yes. Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, we saw, and now we're going to look at Gideon. This is, again, one of my favorites. 6 verse 1. Let's watch this guy's story. All right, stop right there for a sec. So we've got Midian, who's the new oppressor of Israel, right? And you're noticing something that's beginning to happen in verse 2. They made dens for themselves in the mountains and caves in the strongholds. So they literally are, they're so fearful, the Midianites, and you're going to see why in a second. These guys are nasty in terms of how they oppress Israel. They're hiding in the natural caves and stuff that are in the area where they live. Okay, now watch how Midian chooses to deal with Israel. Verse 3.
So it was, whenever Israel had some Midianites would come up, also Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them, then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey.
All right, so what was their plan? How do they execute warfare on Israel, if you will? Yeah, they starve them. So during the harvest, they would simply come in and they would burn everything and then leave. They don't go to war. They're not fighting the people per se. I'm sure there was probably a piece of that, but they're just burning all of their produce, right? So now you've got nothing to live on. It's going to force you to worship them to get, you know, whatever you need from the Midianites. But that's dirty. So you've worked for a year or however long for a harvest. They come in during the harvest time and just set everything on fire, destroy all the produce of the land. So they're nasty, craftily nasty, if you will, in the way that they're handling Israel, right? All the way to Gaza, so all the way to the coast. So the idea is they're coming over the Jordan River from the east, and everything in the land during harvest is destroyed. Verse 4, they would come up and camp against them, destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, leave no sustenance. Sorry, we read that. Verse 5, they would come with their livestock, their tents. They would come in like locusts in number. Both their camels were innumerable, came to the land to devastate it. So they were strong, they were mighty, and they were significant in the way they came in and did that. Okay, so Israel was brought very low because of Midian. And as you've seen this cycle before, what does Israel do at the end of verse 6? They cry out to the Lord, right? So they repent from their following of Baal or whatever Midianite god they were worshiping at that time, Ashtar or Baal. We're going to see them both mentioned in this chapter. They cry out to God, and here's God's solution. Again, odd solution, but here you go, verse 7.
And it came to pass when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel, who said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you out of Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand hand of all who oppressed you, and drove you out before you, or drove them out before you, and gave you their land.
All right, stop there for a second. So why was God using the mouth of a prophet to remind them of these things specifically? What do you notice is Israel's tendency? They did it in the desert, and they're probably doing it now. To forget was a big piece of it, right? So remember, don't forget. So we've seen that reminder over and over again. What did they do specifically with the calf? You guys remember? Aaron makes the golden calf, and after it's finished, he says this about that calf.
This is your God.
What's that?
This is your God.
This is your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, right? So they're attributing the greatness of things past to other gods and forgetting what their God has done. So this prophet comes, unknown, we don't know who he is, and says, as a reminder from God, I am the God who delivered you out of Egypt. I am the God who has done all of these great things. And, verse 10, am I not the Lord your God? You shall not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live, but you have not obeyed me. So he gives them a reminder and then a very stern warning. It's their disobedience that's put them in this situation. Verse 11 now, this angel of the Lord that brought the word through this prophet now is going to turn to our boy Gideon. Verse 11.
The angel of the Lord came and sat under a terebinth tree, at, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash and the Abjurite, while his son Gideon threshed the wheat in the wine presses in order to hide from the Midianites.
All right, verse 11. Let's pause there for a second. So a lot going on here. Angel of the Lord shows up under the oak over the tamarisk tree, as yours says, in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite. That's his pops. Okay, so just remember that Gideon is an Abiezrite, and he is beating out wheat in a wine press in order to save it from the Midianites. Make some observations for me about Gideon. What do you guys know about harvesting wheat? Where is that done? On a mountain, right? Why on a mountain? Right? You take the wheat and the chaff with the pitchfork and you throw it up in the air. The heavier, more valuable grain of the wheat would fall, and the chaff that is lighter would be carried away by the wind. That's called winnowing of wheat, right? It's done in Bethlehem. We'll see it in the book of Ruth. That's the imagery. So you have to be up on a hilltop where there is a breeze to properly winnow wheat. So you get the good stuff separated from the bad stuff. That's how it works. Now, where is Gideon? In a wine press. Where is a wine press? Or what is a wine press? Yeah, some of them are underground. At the very least, they're dug into maybe the side of a hill, right? They are sunken down. Why would you thresh wheat in a wine press? That doesn't make any sense. There's no breeze coming through. If it's underground, there's certainly no visibility. Why would you be there? You're hiding. You're scared to death, right? So you're probably winnowing wheat by hand, separating the wheat from the chaff. It's much more difficult. Why would you be hiding? Fear of who? The Midianites, right? So you're fearful that they're going to come in and destroy your crops. So you've got this guy, Gideon, who's trying to do the right thing. He's trying to save his family, trying to winnow wheat from the harvest so that they have food to eat. And he's doing it in a wine press in order to not be discovered. Okay, so that's the guy that we meet, right? He's faithful, but he's scared to death. That's Gideon, right? Now, that's the picture that we're introduced to of Gideon. Verse 12, though, notice how the angel of the Lord addresses him. See also Clairvoyance or Rene Magritte's painting.
And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, the Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor.
Pardon? Mine says, the Lord is with you, O valiant warrior. Like, is Gideon anywhere in the neighborhood of O valiant warrior? No, but what is the angel of the Lord seeing this guy? He's going to rescue Israel, right? He's going to be the next judge of Israel. Now, he doesn't know that. He doesn't get that. And he's even going to argue with him, kind of like Moses-esque, like, man, you've got the wrong guy. But he sees in him this potential, this leadership ability, and is going to call him up, call him to greatness, because of what he sees in him. Now, verse 13, look at Gideon's response.
Gideon said to him, "Oh, my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened? Why has all this happened to us? And where are all the his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites."
Interpret that for me. 13. There's some great theology in there. Oh Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? Where are all his miracles which our fathers have told us about? Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt? What's wrong with Gideon's theology?
He's got the story, but not the content.
He's heard the stories, okay? What's his assumption in verse 13?
He's saying that, like, well, if God is with them, then, like, only good is going to happen.
Right? That's a great observation. How can God be with us when everything is bad right now? God certainly can't care about us when my situation is run amok, right? That is some jacked theology, if you will. And he's going to get straightened out, but you can see his idea. How is this God that I've heard about the same as the God that I'm supposed to be worshiping now that's allowing me to experience trials and difficulty? That's part of God's plan. The Lord looked at him and said, "Go in this your strength and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you?" So there is now, O valiant warrior, now is the command to, okay, you're going to now lead, deliver Israel. I'm going to use you to free Israel now from the oppression of the Midianites. 15 now, here's Gideon's response. Very logical one.
So he said to him, "Oh, my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least of my father's house."
Are you seeing a theme, by the way, in the people that God continues to choose through the book of Judges? What does Gideon say about who he is? I'm a nobody. My family is the last of an entire tribe, and of that, I'm the youngest in my family. I'm the least of the least. Like, I'm here pressing or winnowing wheat in a wine press right now. Like, I'm just trying to live. I am trying to stay alive and get, you know, 3 square meals in a day. Like, that is my highest goal, and you're picking a guy that has no business doing what you're about to call him to do. And God says, "Oh, no. Oh, valiant warrior, again, I see in you potential and greatness, and I'm calling it out of you," okay? Lord says to him, surely, verse 16, "I will be with you, and you shall defeat Midian as one man." Notice Gideon's response in verse 15, "Oh, Lord, how shall I deliver Israel?" Verse 16, "I will be with you." It isn't you that's going to deliver Israel. I will deliver Israel. You are my means to that end. 17, keep going.
And he said to him, If now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who walk with or who talk with me."
Now notice this. Gideon's going to ask for several of these. He's a guy, he's your doubting Thomas of the Old Testament. He needs signs. He needs tangible. He needs, "God, I believe, but my faith is really, really small. I need you to show me. I need to touch it, feel it, smell it, taste it. I need evidence that you are who you say you are." And he will continue to press God for these sorts of things. So he asked for a sign, and here it is in 18.
"Do not depart from here, I pray, until I come to you and bring out my offering and set it before you." And he said, "I will wait until you come back."
So what's he asked for? What's he going to do? I guess you know a little bit about offerings at this point, having just turned into Leviticus chart to me. He's going to give some type of offering, okay, to God. What does that tell you about in a culture that's worshiping the Midianites? Where is Gideon and his family on that spectrum if he knows about offerings? Would you guess?
Still.
Say it again.
Still.
Yeah, kind of, if not more so. Absolutely. So he's offering offerings. He knows about offerings. So he's still worshiping Yahweh in the midst of this and still offering what God has him to offer in Leviticus. So there's still some sense of godliness in his family. We find out in verse 19, it's not a grain offering. He comes with a young goat, unleavened bread, an ephah of flour. So all of these, he put meat in a basket, broth in a pot, and brought them out to him under the oak or the tamarisk in verse 19 and presents them to this angel of the Lord. Okay? The angel of the Lord said to him, take the meat in verse 20
and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth also. And he did. 21, here's what happens with this offering that is presented by Gideon to the angel of the Lord.
And the angel of the Lord took, and the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand, and it touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire rose from the rock and consumed the meat with the unleavened bread, and the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight.
All right, so that's different, right? So he puts all this offering on a rock. The angel of the Lord sets it on fire in front of Gideon, like out of nowhere. Fire springs up from the rock, consumes the meat, and the angel of the Lord vanishes. So he has this, you said you want a sign? Here's your sign, right? This has probably never happened in all of Gideon's offering, right? So he sees something miraculous, tangible, visible in this moment.
I think we talked about it already, but what's the significance of the tamarack?
We saw it with Abraham way back in the day, and it was... we talked about being that really, really slow-growing tree, and it grows like a, I think it's a foot in diameter every 500 years. So it's one of those things that seems to be a sign of, at least for Abraham, a promise, a belief in the promise that's coming for future generations, because the shade and all the things that would come from the tamarisk are later. So it just, it's one of those places that both is that for him, and then the oak tree, the oak of Moreh we saw in Abraham's story, was also a place of Canaanite worship. So you're going to see it kind of as a both and. So whether this was a place where they worshipped Canaanite deities, not sure. But those are the two pieces that we talked about kind of through our journeys. Okay. So Gideon sees this, verse 22, and he said, "Alas, O Lord God, for now I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." So something about this interaction has gone from just some random dude talking to him to, okay, this is the angel of the Lord. He sees that with his eyes. And then in 23, he says, "Peace to you. Do not fear. You shall not die." Again, fascinating to me that every time we see somebody that has an interaction with the angel of the Lord, this is their response, right? They fear their very lives. Death is perceived to be the next thing that's coming their way because of the holiness of God, and I would assume their lack thereof. Okay? 24, keep going.
"So Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and called it the Lord is peace. To this day it is still in Ophrah of the Jebusites."
All right. So 24, this what I like about... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
The wording changes between like an angel of the Lord and just the Lord.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe part of the evidence where people would say this isn't just an angel. It goes back and forth. There's worship, so it seems to be greater than just an angel. Whether you're going to see Gideon pray a couple times to the Lord, it's like, well, is that the same guy? This seems to be the same character throughout here, identifying him as the Lord. So that's why I take that to be not just an angel, but this is the pre-incarnate Christ, the second person of the Trinity. So the same, the angel of the Lord that we've tracked throughout our story so far.
And that's what it's like,
the capital. Yeah, and I don't know the Hebrew necessarily lends itself to that. People would make that argument that it's sometimes we'll make a bit too much of that. So it's a bit of an interpretation. So I won't take a bullet for it, but I think it is. So, yeah. Now, so Gideon, if you back up a little bit and say, okay, at this point in his life, right, Gideon is, he starts as a scared guy, doesn't have a mission. He's just trying to put food in his belly, provide for his family as a son. Now he's kind of anteed up. He's been called out. He knows whose team he's on. He's been worshiping God, but now he's got a mission. And now the first step in that mission you're going to see is crazy. Okay, verse 25 and following, God's going to ask him to do something. And this is fascinating to me, especially in light of maybe my life, and I think as you guys probably process through yours, before he's going to do anything great externally, before he can go lead a nation, before he can go deliver his people, God's going to call Gideon to make a stand at home. You're going to have to put your faith on display before your family. Why would God call Gideon to do that first? You're going to have to tell your immediate family whose team you're on, and you're going to have to do it by a very significant external act, if you will. Why would that be God's plan?
Family can be the hardest people to tell.
Totally. Why is that?
Closest to you, they have the most influence, and they could hurt you.
Yeah. How many of you guys came to Christ later in life, right? Maybe not as a kid, and had to go home and talk to your family about that experience? What was that like, especially for those of you that didn't have a believing family, that maybe you were the first or this was new or different? Talk to me about that experience. What was that like? Your mom laughed at you? Really?
She came back around like 3 years after.
Yeah, it's gut-wrenching, right? When your own family handles you that way.
Yep.
Yeah. Who else?
My dad quit talking to me for a year.
Are you kidding me? Wow. What was his belief system at the time?
At the time, he's probably an atheist.
Has God changed his heart since then?
He's not saved yet.
I like your attitude. Yeah. My mom thought I was in a cult. Yeah. Started getting phone calls. Like, she was calling former pastors at our Methodist church and doing research on Campus Crusade for Christ and who are these weirdos and Denton Bible Church. And, like, it was not just, okay, you know. It started as that's a phase and he'll grow out of it to he's probably in a cult. This is weird, like, Waco, David Koresh, like, something's going on here. But many of you guys have felt that tension. And why would, I think the idea is, if you can take a stand in those type of situations and say, this is whose team I'm on, with the people that love you the most and know you the most and sometimes can hurt you the most by their words, you can take a stand anywhere, right? So Gideon's going to be called to take a stand at home. And this is tough. And what I love about Gideon is he's obedient, but that fear has not left him, right? He's taking a step, but it's not as if he's this new guy and there's no more fear. He's just going to take a stand for God. That old Gideon is still there, but the obedience and the desire to follow God is winning in terms of who's going to win that battle of fear or obedience. So look at 25, and let's watch now what this angel of the Lord says he must do.
Now it came to pass the same night that the Lord said to him, take your father's goat, young bull, second bull of seven years old, and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the wooden images that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of the rocks in the proper arrangement, and take the second bull and offer the burnt sacrifice with the wood of the images which you shall cut down.
All right, make some observations for me. What's going on? What is Gideon asked to do?
Tear down the idols and burn them.
Okay, so what do you notice about Gideon's home?
Well, his dad owns it.
Yeah, this is in his backyard. This isn't like, hey, go around the corner to the church service where you guys worship. It's like, no. Everybody comes to your house, Gideon, to worship Baal and Ashtoreth, and you have in your backyard altars built to these two false gods. So tell me about his home life. Where did he grow up understanding about sacrifices and offerings and peace offerings? And where does this come from? Did it come from his family? Probably not. So somewhere in the midst of this journey, Gideon has probably been influenced by someone outside of his family to know about these things. Who does Gideon's family worship more than likely? Baal and Ashtoreth, right? So he grows up in a very pagan home. So he's having to take a stand with his pagan parents and tear down the Ashtoreth and the Baal images and then build an altar to God on top of that, okay? Altars, by the way, were very significant in terms of how they built them. You would visibly be able to see one and know which god it was to, in a sense, right? When we go to Israel, y'all won't see him because none of you are coming. Jerk faces, all of you. Some of you are. I'm just teasing. But God said you can build altars out of unhewn stones. You may not cut them and carve them into certain formations. So you could see a hewn altar that was made out of cut stones and go, something's wrong with that. That is not a godly altar. When you saw uncut stones assembled as an altar, you would realize
That's the way that God instructed them to make altars. So as you were able to visibly see these, as the people came out the next day, saw their altars torn down, it wasn't like an upgrade to this new altar to the same gods. They would have recognized that as this is a different altar to a different god, and that's not cool. Okay? So that's where Gideon starts. Tear those down, build a new one on top of the old ones. Okay? 27, watch his response and how he does this.
So Gideon took 10 men from among his servants and did as the Lord said to him. But because he feared his father's household and the men in the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night.
Don't you love that? He's obedient. He's not going to do it at noon, right? He's going to start at about midnight, work till about 4 in the morning, right? He does it at night under the cloak of darkness. Can you imagine like doing a, for any of you guys that have done demo work in the middle of the night, try not to wake people up, right? Rip that down quietly, right? So he brings in all his buddies. They're tearing down the altar, and then they've got to erect another altar out of stone, more than likely, in the place where that sat, so that in this 8 or 10 hour period during the middle of the night, nobody would find out and all this would be done. So he's obedient, right? I like that, but that fear is still there. He does it, and maybe not in this big, bold, like Superman, here am I type way, but he does it the way that maybe you and I would think they're doing it. Like, okay, I'm going to do it, but how can I still save my skin in the process? So love that about Gideon, okay? So he does it, verse 28, and you're going to see God honors this, right? Even though he does it at night, it's still honoring to God. 28, let's see how the men of the city respond. Now notice this too, by the way, not only does he tear down his father's altar, but he uses a bull that was intended to be offered to Baal or Asherah, and he uses it to offer it to God, right? Which would have been expensive, offensive, and you know, so many other things. So this is costing him something. 29, you're about to see how much this is going to cost Gideon.
So they said to one another, who has done this thing? And then and when they had inquired and asked, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing.
Now, why did Gideon do that at night? So nobody would find out. What happens? In like 3 minutes, who did this? That guy? Like, oh, dang it, right? I was just trying to hide. I was just trying to do what God told me. And his worst nightmare comes true, right? Everybody knows he did it. Doesn't get blamed on any of his buddies that helped him do it. It's Gideon, okay? 30. Watch this.
Then the men of the city said to Joash, bring out your son that he may die because he has torn down the altar of Baal. Because he has cut down the wooden image that was beside it.
All right, who's Joash? Gideon's dad. So they say, bring out your son, okay? And we're going to give him a stern verbal warning not to do that again, right? What's the punishment here? I mean, this is a big deal. This isn't a minor stand, right? This is not a, you know, this is significant. I was in seminary. I think I've told you guys the story. We had a guy that came in from a Muslim background. And he talked about his conversion to Christ in the midst of this journey of his. And he was the only person, obviously, in his family that had converted to Christ. He said when he not just got converted, but when he was baptized and had officially identified himself with Jesus, that literally his parents put his picture down on the altar and sent out death threats to kill their son. In that culture, that is what it meant to identify yourself with Christ, right? Oscar got laughed at. I got ridiculed. Carrie Ann had her dad not talk to her. I mean, those are all painful things. But there's something very different about you're going to take a stand for that God, you're going to die. I mean, you're seeing the courage that this would have taken to do this, and yet still Gideon's fear in the midst of it. You understand why he's fearful. He knows with aligning himself to Yahweh, it potentially will cost him his life.
So for Gideon's dad, since he's the owner of this altar, is there any, obviously I'm assuming it's like a status symbol since everybody gathers at his house, but is there like a money that's brought forth, or is there something on top of that status?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think it definitely aligns myself with worship of that God, whether there's money or things to be made off that, I don't know. Gideon's dad's response is very interesting, by the way. If you're a father, you obviously naturally love your kid, right? So he wants to protect him, but yet he's really ticked him off because he's worshiping another god. it's Joash that actually saves Gideon's life, oddly enough. Watch this. This is a beautiful, you talk about wisdom in the moment. Boy, this guy had it. Look at 32. So they say, bring him out. He tore down our altar. We're going to kill him. 31. Here's his answer.
So Joash said to all who stood against him, would you plead for Baal? Would you save him? Let the one who would plead for him be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him plead for himself, because the altar has been torn down.
All right, put that in the Living Bible for me. What does Joash say?
Why can't the God protect himself?
Yeah, if he's God, let God contend for God, right? If he's truly God, then certainly he doesn't need our help to punish and kill the person that tore down his altar. So now if you're a worshiper of Baal, what do you say to that? Well, yes, he does need our help. Well, then he's not God. So Joash is brilliant in the way he's done this. Hey, if this is indeed our God, he's powerful enough to defend for himself, and may the person who defends Baal be killed for defending Baal, right? He's strong enough. So beautiful, brilliant response, if you will, as to how he gets his son out of this. And obviously Baal has no power, so Gideon's all good. 32, therefore on that day they named him Jerubbaal, which means, anybody got a note on 32 as to what that means?
Let Baal contend.
Yeah, let Baal contend. I mean, let Baal fight for Baal, okay? So that's his new name. We'll see him identified to that. Again, not as God changing his name, but the city, or the people of the city changing his name to that. So let Baal contend against him, because he has torn down the altar. So how's Gideon do thus far? Okay. I could have done better. Yeah, Eric.
Do you think maybe his father's response comes from, like, do you think there's just a lot of syncretism? So, like the dad might believe in God, but he's like, oh, but if this helps me grow my crops or whatever.
Absolutely. You never see in Israel a complete abandonment of God. It's always syncretism. It's always, yeah, but. So I'm going to worship God, but I'm also going to have all these other good luck charms or whatever it is to help grow my crops or whatever it may be. So it's kind of always pieced together. Yeah. So, but Gideon's done well. He stepped up. He's fearful, and you're going to continue to see that in him. But he's taking steps of obedience that are giving him more confidence in his God and what the plan is. And man, he's had now at this point death threats for taking a stand for God, and God delivers him. I mean, this is insane. Through the mouth of his idol-worshipping father, saves his life. So, beautiful picture of God delivering this guy. Okay? Now, 33, now we're going to go to a new chapter, if you will, of Gideon's story.
Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east gathered together, and they crossed over and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and then he blew the trumpet, and the Abizites gathered him behind him.
All right, so this is his family. The Abizrites gathered to follow him. So now the Midianites have come like locusts. They're filling the valley. There's a ton of them. But now he's rallying the troops. What do you notice is different about Gideon at this point? What is he doing? He's starting to lead, right? He's calling his family to say, hey, come fight with me. You've seen the stand that I took for God. And they're going, man, this guy's got some... You know, he's worth following. So they send out people. They follow him. He blows the trumpet. He's rallying the people. 35, he sent out messengers through Manasseh. They were also called together to follow him. He sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, Naphtali, and they came to meet him. So in his local area, to the tribes that were around him, were just basically south of the Sea of Galilee. So the tribes that were in that area now rallied to him. Okay? Verse 26, this or 36 rather, this is his message.
So Gideon said to God, If you will save Israel by my hand, you as you have said, look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only and it is dry on the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand.
All right, so what's Gideon saying now? I need another sign. Okay, I did this. You came through, right? We're good. But now I need something else. And if you're really going to deliver Israel through me, this is insane, then I need a sign. What's he asked for? Yeah, some dew. He wants a Mountain Dew is what he wants. He's going to take a fleece, some skin of an animal. He's going to put it on the threshing floor, right? An actual threshing floor. And he says, if the dew is only on the fleece and not on the ground, then I'm going to know that this is legit, that you are going to deliver Israel through me. Okay? 38. And it was so. When he arose early in the morning, he squeezed the fleece. He drained the dew from the fleece into a bowl of water. So all the dew is on the fleece. None of the dew is on the ground. And then Gideon goes, huh, maybe I asked for the wrong thing. This is hilarious. 39, he says, okay, God, do not let your anger burn against me that I may speak once more. Please let me make a test once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry on the fleece and let there be dew on the ground. I have no idea why he thought this would be a bigger miracle, or I have no idea. But he says, now we want the fleece dry and the ground wet as opposed to the opposite. Verse 40, watch God's exceeding patience with Gideon.
God did so that night, and it was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew all along the ground.
Isn't that crazy? So he's asked now for three signs. He's gotten every one of them, and God is patient with his doubting. In the midst of him trying to walk in obedience, God knows he's got issues, right? And is patient with him, allows him to ask for signs. God delivers the signs that he asked for in order to prove this is indeed how I'm going to rescue Israel through your hand. Okay? Someone had a hand up. Adolf, you good?
Yeah.
All right. Chapter 7 now. Let's move into the issues with the Midianites. 7:1. All right, so they're camped out. They're ready to fight. Keep rolling.
The Lord said to Gideon, the people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me.
So Gideon finally gets enough courage to lead. He rallies 32,000 people to come fight for him. And what does God say? That's too many. We can't possibly have that many people against the Midianites who are too numerous to number. You've got too many. Okay, so Gideon says, okay, 3. Now therefore proclaim in the hearing of the people, whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and go home. So if you're afraid, like if you've come, but you're like me and you're scared, go home. So verse 3, 22,000 people returned and 10,000 remained. So we just took 2/3 of your army and sent them home. Now you got 10,000, okay? We're good. The Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many, verse 4. So now he's going to do this. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. It shall be that he to whom I say, this one shall go with you, and he whom I say, but everyone else is basically, he's going to say, they're going to go home, okay? Verse 5, he's going to now bring them to the water, these 10,000 people, and we're going to whittle them down even further, okay? Now, this is the test. Now, you guys figure out what this means. Verse 5, read that.
So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, he shall set by himself. Likewise, everyone who kneels down to drink.
Okay, what does that mean? He's distinguishing, he's going to take the people to the water, and he's distinguishing how they drink the water. Okay, how does a dog lap water? With its tongue. So it sticks its face down in the water. Okay, so that's one picture. The other one are those who kneel to drink. What's the picture? What's the difference in the two? Yeah, probably bringing it up to their hand, right? So the picture is there's people that are just going to stick their head in the water. They're going to be unaware of their surroundings and just drink. And there's others that are going to be watching and drinking with their hands. The idea is that they're kind of ready to fight, though they're still taking care of their needs. That's the picture as best we can tell. Okay. Now, verse 6, here's who did what.
And the number of those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouths, was 300 men.
So we got 300 of the 10,000 that bring their hand to their mouth. The other 9,700 stuck their face in the water, okay? All the rest kneeled to drink water. Verse 7, the Lord said to Gideon, I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped and gave the Midianites, and will give the Midianites into your hands. So let all the other people go, each to his home. We started with 32,000 people. How many do we have left? 300. That's less than 1% of who showed up, right? Yes. Moving my decimal. That's insane. So God says, okay, now we're good. Now, again, what was God's purpose in this? Why did he whittle them down to 300? No, so we can make a movie about it and call it 300. That's why he did that. No. Right? You're not going to be arrogant. You're going to think if you have 32,000 people that you did this. But you're a least and a last. So I'm going to take the fewest number of people. I'm going to stack the cards, stack the deck against myself, and I'm going to win the day, and you're going to see that I'm the guy that showed up. I brought you victory. Not you, not your power, not your people. There's nothing that you could possibly look to say it was anything other than God. You want some of that? I'll give you some of that. Yeah, you wonder. Okay, I'd have given you 32,000, but you asked for fleece and dew and whatever. Now we're going down to 300 people. Yeah, you know. No, just all right. Speaking in tongues over there. I don't know what's going on. Hallelujah. All right. Fabulous. All right, so we're whittled down now to 300 people. Let's watch the battle. Verse 8. Okay, so I'm going to deliver this camp to you. You're on the hillside, they're in the valley, and I'm going to deliver this people to you. But watch this.
But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Pura, your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands shall be strengthened to go down again.
All right, so I'm going to deliver the people, but Gideon, I know you. If you're scared, take your boy Pura, your armor bearer, what have you, and go down to their camp, and you're going to overhear a conversation. Okay, what do you think Gideon's going to do? Door number one or door number two? I'm going to take door number two, and I'm going to go find out what they're going to say. Sure enough, verse 11, he went with Pura, his servant, down to the outpost of the army that was in the camp. Okay, verse 12, the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the sons of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Can you imagine just the fear that that would have brought you, thinking, Lord, really? I just sent home 30,000 people, right? And now we've got 300. How in the world? I can't even count them. I can't even count their camels, right? How in the world are we going to deal with this people, okay? Verse 13, here is how God now inspires Gideon, or strengthens him, if you will. 13. What's the picture here? A loaf of barley bread. Something small and something weak rolled through this massive camp and destroyed it. You guys see the picture? So that's the image that he is left with in a dream. His friend replied in verse 14, "This is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian and all... into his hand." So his buddy says, "Man, this is from the Lord. This has been inspired. You are the loaf of bread. You are the barley. You're going to roll through the camp, and God is going to deliver us this way." So even again, still in the midst of his doubting, God inspires him, gives them a dream. Gideon heard in verse 15 the account of the dream and its interpretation, that he bowed in worship and he returned to the camp. And he says now in verse 15, "Arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into our hands." Verse 16, he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put the trumpets and empty pitchers into the hands of all of them with torches inside the pitchers. So Gideon has an idea. You're going to see these torches and pitchers, and you're going to see he's got a strategy. He's thought through this, okay? Verse 17, this is powerful. Read that. What do you notice in Gideon? What's changed? Is this the Gideon that we met in chapter 6 that was threshing wheat in a wine press, that was scared to death? What is he saying? He's leading. Do as I do. When we get there, watch me. I will show you what to do. Like, man, this guy is growing. That fear is still there, right? He's still Gideon, but he's stepping out in obedience and faith, and God is using him in a powerful way. Do as I do. I mean, we're seeing a very different chapter in his life. And it's because of God's past faithfulness with him that he can go, God, you've been faithful with me. You called me to do crazy stuff. I stepped out in obedience, scared to death of how my father would respond, how the city would respond when I hewn their altars. But man, here we go. So you're faithful, and I can trust you. Verse 18, keep going. There's the plan, okay? So when I blow the trumpet, y'all watch me. Keep going, verse 19.
So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch.
Okay, so it's nighttime, okay, the middle watch. So it's late into the evening, dark. Keep going.
When they had just set the watch. And they blew the trumpets and smashed the jars that were in their hands.
Okay, why would you do that? They blew the trumpets and smashed the jars. What are they doing? They're making a ton of noise, right? So you've got these porcelain pictures or what pictures that you have. They're smashing those together. Why is that important given the number of men that they have?
Makes them bigger.
Yeah, exactly. You can't see them because it's night, but all you hear is this tremendous ruckus. And you're thinking, holy cow, in a valley that probably would have echoed off the mountains, they're making a ton of noise, okay? Feigning like they're bigger than they really are. And then in verse 20, keep going.
Then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the jars. They held in their left hands the torches and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon.
All right, so now they're screaming. They've got the torches in their hands so they can see at least 300 torches obviously coming down the hill at them. Now watch how God wins this battle, 21 and 22. What does that mean?
They start killing each other,
right? They wake up in a panic. They hear this noise. They see these torches and people just getting swords out and they can't see anything. They're confused. And literally, you got Midianites killing Midianites. And the 300 are kind of just watching this happen, right? So it's fascinating how God chooses to win this battle, right? They are outnumbered by a long shot and yet God shows up, okay? Keep going. Yeah, they go east, okay? They flee to the east, okay? Men of Israel were summoned in verse 23 from Naphtali and Asher, all of Manasseh, and they pursued Midian. So they chased them back east, back home, okay? Now, 24, you're going to see the beginnings of something that we haven't seen before. Watch this.
24?
Please. Okay, so who does Gideon now summon? What tribe?
Ephraim.
So for whatever reason, he is delayed in summoning Ephraim, probably because they were farther away and just weren't in the immediate vicinity of the people that he had rallied. But now that they have the upper hand and kind of the tide has turned to Israel's favor, he's rallying more people saying, I need your help, okay? And I need you to take Midian at the waters before them as far as Beth-horon and the Jordan. So I need you guys to deliver us over in kind of the location where these guys are fleeing, okay? Verse 25, they captured the two leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, and they kill now these two leaders. Killed Oreb on the rock of Oreb, Zeb on the winepress of Zeb, very creative name, so you die there, you get it named after you. While they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon across the Jordan. Deliver those guys, get them for me. Ephraim steps up, deliver them, kill them, and now they're bringing the heads of these two guys back to Gideon. Now, 8 verse 1, watch this.
Then the men of Ephraim said to him, what is this that you have done to us, not to call us when you went to fight against Midian? And they accused him fiercely.
So whoa, what's Ephraim's response in this? What do they say to Gideon?
Why didn't you call us?
Dude, what the heck? why didn't you pick up the phone? Like, man, you're going to battle and you completely left us out. And they're offended. They're frustrated, right? Why didn't you call us? And that's a fair response. Now, Gideon is going to be put in a very interesting leadership situation, okay? He could do a couple things at this point. How could he respond at this point? How would you respond, right? They've been obedient. They've done what you've asked. They've got two heads in their hands. But they're pointing the finger at you, and they're offended that you didn't call them and ask them to join the battle. What would be the temptation at this point if you're Gideon?
We didn't need you.
Yeah, we didn't need you. This is about me. I led these people. I tore down this altar. God's using me to do this, right? The temptation possibly for him could have been to defend his turf and his territory, maybe his character. I want my name in the paper. Watch how Gideon handles this situation. This is beautiful. Yeah, Max.
Sorry, just to go back a little bit. When God tells Gideon to take his servant and go listen to men, who are these? Are these men part of the 300? Or because I was under the impression that he went down into the camp.
Correct.
The Midianites.
Correct. So he goes and spies on the Midianites with Purah, and they hear the Midianites having this conversation. So this guy has a dream that the barley loaf rolls through their camp.
So the Lord sends a dream to one of the Midianites?
Basically. And they hear them talking about that. And he goes, that's from the Lord. That's you, Gideon. That's us destroying them tonight, right? So yeah. Yep. Crazy. So whatever means God wants to use, right? He uses. So they contend with him. Verse 2, look at Gideon's response.
And he said to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer?
Okay, what does that mean? First of all, what have I done now in comparison with you? What is he saying? What you've done is better than what I've done. All I did was smash a bunch of pitchers together and run these guys out of camp. What you did was what? You just killed the two leaders, and you're walking back with them heads in hands, right? You guys are amazing. Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim, i.e. the Ephraimites, which you guys just did, better than the vintage of Abiezer, meaning he's an Abiezerite. So he's comparing, again, you're better than me. So how does Gideon handle this? He exalts them, lowers himself. He doesn't need to be the guy. He doesn't need to have his name in the paper, if you will. He is totally content saying, y'all take the credit. That's awesome, right? You came and fought. What you've done is far more important than what I've done. I mean, do you see how the security he has as a leader, like internally, to be able to say, man, that's fine. Y'all are great, right? Even in the midst of it costing him a little bit of press or limelight, he's willing to set all that aside, okay? God has given, listen to this, God has given the leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, into your hands, and what was I able to do in comparison to you? What a beautiful statement. God has delivered these men into you. I am nothing. Today is about you guys. How do you think the men of Ephraim are going to respond to that?
Well, okay, cool.
Big deal. Thank you. You know, like they get it. Thus his anger toward him, thus their anger toward him subdued when he said that. Proverbs, I almost saw it for you guys this morning, but I didn't want to spoil it. Turn real quick to Proverbs 15:1. This is a great, great leadership quality. Somebody read that when you get there. 15:1. So how does Gideon respond? A gentle answer. With a word, he is able to immediately extinguish their anger. Now, had he responded like tit for tat, like, oh yeah, like you want some of that? You know what I did today? I had to take 300 dudes. I had 32,000 people. And got, you know, like if he would have, you know, patted his own back, if you will, that would have been horrible, and he would have stirred up their anger. But immediately, because of his humility, he's able to quench that anger, exalt these men, And now they're on the same team, if you will. Remember that, right? As a leader, to be able to respond in the midst of tension, of maybe back and forth, of egos and things like that. And when you're able to deflect that and just take it and then respond with kindness and gentleness and a soft tongue to not defend yourself or your territory or whatever, immediately the situation is diffused. So maybe not something that gets exalted as a great leadership quality enough, but Gideon has it, and he's able to diffuse that situation instantaneously. Now, by the way, as kind of a bigger picture thing, what are you beginning to see between the tribes of Israel? This is the first instance that we've seen since they've entered the land.
There's really no connection or communication.
Yeah, there's some, because of the geography and just the natural layout of the land, there's division. And there's not communication necessarily between all these tribes. And you're gonna see the tension with that. So what is it causing? Strife and rifts, right? So this is kind of a natural, consequence is the wrong word, but it's just a natural part of them separating and living in a territory. This is my hometown, and you live in that hometown. And the more that we do life together, the less we're doing life with you, and the more we're different, and the less that we're the same. So they've lived life apart now for 100 years or so. I don't know how long we've been through the book of Judges at this point, but they've lived a generation apart, and you're beginning to see these natural barriers begin to influence them, where they don't feel like they're all on the same team like they were when they crossed the Jordan together and came out of Egypt together and was all one big happy family of 3 million people, right?
So, like, Judges never really addresses the Levites, like, what's happened with their tribe during this whole time. Since they're kind of like supposed to be the glue that kind of holds.
Yep. We'll see them. They're coming. But you're definitely seeing a lack of spiritual growth. Now, whether that's because the Levites aren't doing their job or the people are just so busy worshiping other gods that they don't care, it's a little of both. But the Levites will reappear. By the end of the book of Judges, this just gets darker and worse in terms of spiritual temperature of the land. It is just quickly going down. Okay, we are going to come within a hair of extinguishing an entire tribe from Israel. We're going to see a civil war develop between Israel where Hebrews are fighting Hebrews, brothers, sisters to sisters. I mean, it's nasty, and you're seeing the beginning of this now. Okay, this same tribe, by the way, Ephraim, is going to rise up in a couple more judges under Jephthah, and they are going to have a beef, and Jephthah, the current judge that's sitting on the, whatever judge sits on, at that time, is going to handle it very different. He's not going to be the soft, gentle response that Gideon was. He's going to call them to account. And he's seeing that some of this within Ephraim was not true. And Gideon chooses to kind of look over that. So it's fascinating to me that Gideon doesn't even necessarily need to defend himself, knowing that some of what came out of that tribe's mouth was untrue and kind of a character attack. He just lets it go for the sake of the bigger picture of maintaining peace within the tribes and not fighting for territory that day. Jephthah is going to handle it very different, okay? Two very, very different leaders, if you will, okay? But both good in a sense, okay? So that's where we're at. So we've killed Oreb and Zeeb. We had a tension that was elevated that Gideon quickly puts out because of his wisdom and soft tongue. Verse 3 now, we see that. And now in verse 4, we've got to continue. We're not done.
And Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over, he and the 300 men who were with him, exhausted yet pursuing.
You guys ever been there? Like, that was my theme verse through seminary. Weary yet pursuing. Like, just keep going, right? For those of you guys that have been in those seasons of life where you've got work and you've got school and you've got responsibilities and you're like, man, I just want a day off. I just need some time, but you've got to keep pushing and you know that's there. That's where Gideon is, man. What they need more than anything is rest, but they can't rest now. And Gideon realizes that, man. If he starts a feud, they're going to miss the opportunity to defeat Midian. So forget about that. We got to push on. We're weary yet pursuing. Verse 5.
So he said to the men of
Sukkoth, yeah.
Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I'm pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian.
All right. Sukkoth is on the east side of the Jordan. These are friends, not foes. Okay, so he's asking them, hey, look, we're pursuing Midian. We're all on the same team here, you and I. Give my men food. We're weary so that we can continue our battle. Okay, and he tells them exactly what he's doing. And here's the response that he gets from these guys in verse 6.
And the officials of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your army?
What does that mean? Put that in Living Bible for me.
So if you're not going to win, then we're screwed.
Yeah, that's exactly what it means. Have you already won the day? Well, if you had, and you had their heads in your hands, we would feed you. But if not, and you lose, then we've just aligned ourselves with you, and we're screwed. So, no, we're not going to feed you. And Gideon says, okay. You want to play that way? Let's play that way. So here's his response. Just in case you were wondering if Gideon had the gall to do something hard, he's got it. 7.
So Gideon said, well then, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with prayers.
Which is awesome. He basically says, I'm going to treat you like a child. And I'm going to put your hands on the chalkboard, and we're going to get out the switch, and we're going to spank your behinds. Okay? Like, I just love how it comes out. He just says, all right then. You know, what did you say? Well then.
Yeah, well,
beautiful. Well then. Okay. All right. You want to play that game? I will spank you like a little child when I get home. So I will discipline you with thorns and briars. It doesn't sound pleasant. Okay. And sure enough, he's going to. Okay. Verse 8. Keep going.
And from there he went up to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men from Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered.
So he's desperate for food, and he's got two towns, again, on the east side of the Jordan, within the land of Israel, within the tribes that are on the east side of the Jordan's land, but they will not align themselves with him. You guys, now you're seeing the tension on the east side of the Jordan. Like, who are you to us? Man, we're like Switzerland. We're not for you, but we're not against you. We're just kind of here. So, again, that tension is developing between the tribes where there's just not that sense of team and camaraderie, and we're all Israel. Some type of like switch or whatever that you would use, like I don't know, like a weed or whatever that would have been prickly or something, to something like that. Okay, so something unpleasant to get spanked with. So I told you my story about the wooden spoons in my house growing up. Yeah, okay. Moving on. It's the wooden spoon of their day. So he says basically the same thing. Verse 9, so he spoke and said to the men of Penuel, when I return safely, I will tear down this tower. So I'm going to rip down your city for not aligning yourselves with the people that you should have aligned yourselves with. Okay? Keep rolling, verse 10.
Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor with their army, about 15,000 men, all who were left of all the army of the people of the east, for there had fallen 120,000 men who drew the sword.
They've lost a lot of people. Keep going.
And Gideon went up by the way of the tent dwellers east of Nabah and Jogabah and attacked the army, for the army felt secure. And Zeba and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic.
Man, God is just like blessing this guy, winning battles. He's outnumbered, but God continues to promise deliverance, which that's what he said to Gideon. That's what I'm going to do. You asked for 2,700 signs. I gave you all of them, and we're doing it. Gideon, the son of Joash, verse 13, returned from the battle, captured a youth from Succoth and questioned him. So tell me basically where everybody's hiding out, these elders, these 77 men in verse 14. He comes to the men of Succoth and says, behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, concerning whom you taunted me. By the way, you asked if I had their heads in my hands. Oh, look what I have. Their heads in my hands. You taunted me with these. Look what I got. You should have sided with me from the beginning. And he's basically mocking them as they mocked him. Are the heads of Zalmunna already in your hands that we should align ourselves with you? Verse 15, while we were weary. And he says, oh, look, now I got them. Verse 16, here comes your punishment.
And he took the elders of the city. He took thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson.
That just had to be funny, right? You've got the elders of the city, grown men, right? Fathers, they're taken outside and they're getting spanked by younger men, which is, you know, they're just... That was his lesson for him. So that had to be humiliating. Then in verse 15, he tears down the altar of Penuel and he kills the men of the city because of their not aligning with them. So it's not just an offense, but he actually kills the men of the city in verse 17 in that town, in Penuel, not in Succoth. Okay? Then he said to Zeba and Zalmunna, what kind of men were they that killed, whom you killed at Tabor? And he said, they were like you, each one resembling the son of a king. So these two kings who you he's captured, now he's interrogating them. And he says, tell me who you killed. Who have you done wrong to? Wanting to know if they had killed his own brothers or not. And notice their response in verse 18. They were like you, each one resembling the son of a king. What are they doing to Gideon right now, these captives? They're buttering him up. They are kissing his backside, right? Oh, Gideon, you are so great, right? What is their hope with that? If I tell Gideon how great he is, then what? Yeah, they'll let me live. My punishment will be less or what have you, okay? But the problem is, verse 19.
They were my brothers, the sons of my mother, or my mother, and the, as the Lord lives, if you had let them live, I would not kill you.
Those were my brothers, the sons of my mother, whom you killed from other tribes. Those are my people. Had you let them live, I would have let you live, but you didn't. So he says in verse 20 to Jether, his firstborn son, rise and kill them. But he was a youth; he did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a youth. And then Zeba and Zalmunna said, and they taunt Gideon again. This is funny. Rise up yourself, fall on us, for as a man, so is his strength. So they taunt Gideon to their death. Kissing up didn't work, so maybe they think the other side would work. So Gideon arose, and he killed Zeba and Zalmunna, took the crescent ornaments, which were on the camel's necks. These would have been probably signs of strength, and maybe even the worship of their false gods. And he kills these two leaders. So battle's done. They've killed Oreb and Zeb. They've killed Zeba and Zalmunna. All the leaders of the opposing army are dead. And in 22, watch what is beginning to now happen because of the division in Israel.
And the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us both, you and your sons and your grandsons also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian.
Okay, interpret that for me. We've never seen this before. What is he saying? What are they saying to Gideon? We want you to be our king. And not just we want you to be our king. What are we asking for? We want a dynasty. So you have the ability today to be our king and to start a dynasty that your son and your son's sons will be kings over us forever. Wow. That's quite the offer. So you're seeing, in one sense, the vision. Like, we need, like Zeba and Zalmunna, like Oreb and Zeb, we need a leader over us that can unite us, just like all the other nations, right? You saw the temptation that God said you're going to have. When you get into the land, I'm not going to be enough. You're going to want a king, Deuteronomy 17, and I'm going to say no, and you're going to say yes. I'm going to say no, you're going to say yes, and I'm finally going to say, okay, if that's what you want, I'm going to give it to you. And you see the desire of the people to have this king. And for Gideon, that had to be a huge temptation, right? Power, wealth, significance, not just for him, but his family. Like, that's a significant offer, okay? Watch what Gideon says. Look at this young man's character.
But Gideon said to him, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you.
Golly, this guy's got, like, depth of character. No, that's not what God wants. God is our leader. He will rule over you, not me, nor my son. So he... just, again, that ego's in check. He's able to put all that aside, all the things that would have maybe called to his flesh. He says, no, God's going to rule over us. Then Gideon does something odd here in 24. I don't know if it's odd or it just gets interpreted by the people wrongly, but it seems so out of context. 24 and following, read that.
And Gideon said to them, I would like to make a request of you that each of you would give me the earrings from his plunder, for they had gold earrings.
So they take from this plunder a bunch of earrings. Gideon says, I want one from everybody. He takes all these earrings. In verse 25, they gave them to him. He spread them out. Verse 26, the weight was 1,700 shekels of gold, which is a bunch. Verse 27, Gideon made it into an ephod, a golden ephod. What is a ephod? Where have we heard that word before? Yeah, the priests wear an ephod. That would have been the garment that they put over them. That would have symbolized them being the priests with the stones and what have you. So Gideon, for whatever reason, says, I'm going to make an ephod. And look how it's interpreted in 27.
And Gideon made it into an ephod and set it up in his city, Ophrah. And all Israel played the harlot with it there. It became a snare to Gideon and his house.
So what happens after he makes this ephod? They all start worshiping it, and probably with it, played the harlot, has the idea of Baal and Ashtoreth, and they were doing exactly what they were doing that got them into this mess to begin with. The same thing that Gideon delivered them from in chapter 6. Now, whether Gideon was trying to elevate the Levites or make a, I don't know, they certainly didn't see it this way. Now, this seems inconsistent with who Gideon is, but we're going to see in verse, look at verse 30 and read that.
Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives.
So he's got 70 kids, right? This is like Solomon-esque. He's got a gazillion wives and a gazillion kids from all these wives. So you're seeing some inconsistencies with him, but yet he's still worshiping God. Verse 32, and Gideon the son of Joash died at a ripe old age and was buried in the tomb of his father. In verse 32, in Orpah, his hometown of the Abiezrites. Then it came about, as soon as Gideon died in verse 32, that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. So it seems like, and this is my interpretation of this, he made this golden ephod. They misinterpret that, worship wrong gods, and Gideon says, no, that's not what I meant. They live the rest of their duration underneath Gideon's reign by worshiping Yahweh, and then when he dies, they punt again and start worshiping Baal and make a covenant with him, which is what, by the way, 33, Baal Berith, that word Berith literally means covenant. It's the word covenant we see all throughout our Old Testament. So it's a strong word in that they are entering into a covenant relationship with another god, which was even more offensive than just, you know, putting that guy on your mantle, another G.I. Joe figure, if you will. So that's how I see it. I think there's room to see it certainly differently, but based on Gideon's track record and tenure and what he's calling them to, it seems inconsistent that he would immediately jump back into Baal worship, but man, we've seen dumber things out of leaders. So, man, I don't know, but odd deal. And the 70 wives thing's a little concerning as well. So you all figure it out. So I like to look at Gideon half full. And the text seems a little bit unclear. So anyway, that's Gideon's end, if you will. So 6, 7, and 8, this beautiful picture of a guy who starts in utter fear as a nobody. The angel of the Lord sees this great potential in him. He takes little steps of obedience. God is with him the whole way. And as a result of God showing up, he has the ability now to look back on past victories that God has given him to allow him to step forward in more significant ways. And his life is left here with now an amazing track record of faithfulness in the midst of fear. So that's kind of Gideon to me. And I think that's why I like him, that he's just a normal everyday dude like you and me that is scared but yet obedient and is not bowing down and cowering to fear. He chooses to walk in obedience even though it's hard. And is, at the end of the day, I think that's how at least I choose to remember him, as a guy that stepped out in faith and trust God and has a great legacy as a result. So there's your boy Gideon, 6, 7, and 8. All right? Thoughts on him as we move on to, wait a few minutes, Gideon's son, who's a very different dude.
So as I was kind of tracking it, it seems like because he was so like lowly that like God started exalting him, and then he was really humble throughout it.
Mm-hmm.
So he starts stepping into that leadership role slowly but surely, and then he does well. And then like kind of the way I saw that ending was like, it was kind of like why I think Paul tells Timothy not to have any like new pastors, you know, because like that are new converts to the faith, that like they start getting that pride in them. And I mm-hmm. think that's what happened with Gideon, is when they asked him to be king, he's like, oh no, I won't be king, but you know, like give me a little praise yeah. with the gold,
yeah.
you know. And then he creates an ephod that wasn't asked by God, you know.
Right.
The ephod was like very particular in how it was supposed mm-hmm. to be made. Then that started, it says in mine that caused Gideon and his family, it was a snare to them,
yeah.
that ephod. And then like from there, like the whole wives thing starts happening. So I think it was that,
yeah,
like because he was so like new and like
that power is so new to him, why he likes straight away.
Man, I think that is a very valid interpretation, and it is quite likely that's exactly what happened. So power went to his head, and he caved to it. So, and in a day and age when, man, it's dark spiritually, that is certainly a, it's certainly a valid interpretation. So, yeah, I don't know at the end of the day. So you guys can keep studying, look into it, and see what you see. That's a hard one. It's tough to see a guy's life that, man, that was 90% great, and then in the end maybe he succumbs to pride or money or power or whatever. So who knows? But, yeah, that's a tough one. Any other thoughts on Gideon as we wrap him up? Correct.
Okay, because when I was in Sunday school way back in the day, I was taught that he separated them by the ones who were fit and the ones who weren't. So the ones that weren't fit were like, oh, I need water. And the other ones who weren't fit were like, oh, I'm good.
Potentially, yeah, that would make sense as well. Yeah, they're in the Harod Spring, and they're in a valley. There's a hill up the side, which is where they are. So that would make sense as well. I think it's a valid, given the landscape and where they're fighting, absolutely. They would have been trekking up, and they would have at least went down the hill to go get water. So certainly, that is a very potential valid interpretation. So, yeah, don't know. Okay, why don't we finish up there, gang? We'll pick up next week on Gideon's son Abimelech and kind of the fallout of this young man. He is not his dad in any way, shape, or form. So, you guys have a great weekend. Enjoy yourselves. Be safe. And we will see you next Thursday.